this morning is United States v. Long.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent Mr. Douglas Long. My name is Andrew J. McGowan, and I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. We've raised three issues in our brief. One is an upward departure issue, one is a suppression issue, and the third is a Booker issue. And I don't intend to talk about the suppression issue unless there are any questions. And the departure issue seems to have lost some of its luster since Booker came down.
Mr. McGowan, I have a question for you in terms of all of this Booker stuff. This case involves quite a few adjustments under the guidelines. And my question is, if we're to just say that, you know, there's sort of never plain error if the guidelines are correct, or there's always plain error, then I guess either way the answer to my question is pretty clear. But if we take a middle ground and we have some sort of limited remand, is it necessary for us to decide, you know, whether, you know, it was use of a computer, whether it was sadistic or masochistic or more than 600, you know, all of these different guidelines adjustments, or all these particular adjustments sort of off the table? Should our court just not even worry about them?
I'm sorry, are you talking about determining whether there was a Sixth Amendment violation?
Well, that's right. I mean, everybody is coming along, and I mean everybody for the last week and a half, and saying, you know, people in your position, Booker is now the law, the guidelines are discretionary, plain error has been shown. Pretty much everyone at this phase of our lives is in the plain error world, and so we want more sentencing. And my question for you is, are the adjustments and the various calculations under the sentencing guidelines of continuing relevance if we were to remand, or are they not?
Actually, I believe they are relevant simply because the Supreme Court said in its remedy procedure that the district court is supposed to take into account the guidelines.
So you think we ought to at least tell the district court, yes, you understood, you know, these various guidelines correctly and applied them correctly to the record before you, or, you know, no, you didn't?
My impression of what happens after Booker is that guideline issues still exist. Now, of course, district courts can, at this point, as far as I can tell, mitigate, so to speak, or aggravate whatever the guideline range was, turns out to be. But it seems to me pretty clear that Booker instructs district courts to determine what the guideline range is to begin with.
Okay, so in your case, if we think that the district court here correctly applied all these various adjustments under the guidelines, and we also know that he chose to depart upward four levels, which by my calculation is just about right if you assume that each level is a doubling of the number of images from the last level, so I can actually even see a way of putting it within the structure of the guidelines, isn't this even more so than simply sentencing at the top of a guideline range an indication that it's really a pointless act to ask Judge Mim, would you have imposed a different sentence if you'd had discretion? Because it takes a certain amount of discretion anyway to depart upward. And he went up four levels.
That's true. And I don't think it's pointless, though. And for a couple of reasons. And first of all, let me just say, I don't agree with this limited remand idea at all. And I think it really amounts to an advisory opinion that you're asking the district court to make. I don't think it's fair to the district court either. Because you're asking the district court to imagine, hypothetically, as you pointed out earlier, that based on a hearing that was flawed, based on information that was based on that hearing that was flawed, and based on the judge's recollection, in some of these cases we're talking about 2 years ago, whether the judge would have done something differently. And it is true, as this court very candidly pointed out, some judges may say, well, I don't want to do it again. But on the other hand, the judges that we appear before that you're familiar with are all very conscientious. And I just don't think it's fair to them, in fact, to make them come to this conclusion without a litigated hearing for the very reasons that you pointed out earlier, Judge King. And so I don't agree with the limited remand idea at all. But in terms of this case in particular, because there was an upward departure, and the judge sentenced him to a particular sentence, in fact said, I think this is a fair and just sentence.
Right.
I think in this case, it was a first offense. It was a possession charge. It wasn't distribution. And there were certain elements in the offense, in the hearing itself, the flawed hearing, that really touched Judge Mim. And he actually mentioned, he said, I read your letters of support. There's a terrible sadness that comes over me every time I have a sentencing like this. And I'm even made sadder when I read letters like this, because it's obvious that prior to the time that all of this came out, you may not have had a picture book life, but close to it. You had a good job. You came from a good family. You had a very nice wife, loving wife. You had friends. I mean, I actually teared up when I read this letter from your friend from college. Now, that had an emotional effect on Judge Mim, but in a rehearing, some of those factors could be argued under 3553 with the various factors that are now sort of equivalent to the guideline range for a lower sentence. And as this court pointed out already today, if the range were larger, the question is where would the judge start from that range? And in this case, the upward departed. But that may be because Judge Mim follows the guidelines, follows the commission's statements that this is the guideline range for somebody with pictures. And you've got more pictures, so I got to go higher. What if the guideline range were whatever the range, the statutory range, where would he start for a first offender who technically didn't hurt personally, well, in this case, there was a better matter, but the judge didn't take that into account. But as far as the offense of conviction, he didn't. And I think that in this case in particular, a very compelling argument could be made under 3553 factors to argue for a lower sentence.
As I read the sentencing transcript, the judge gave full and ample consideration to any and all mitigating factors that were present in this case and upwardly departed anyway. So how can that constitute plain error?
Well, all of the factors in this case are aggravating except for acceptance of responsibility under the guidelines. This sentencing hearing was based on a guideline analysis of what was important about this case. The commission thinks all of these factors, aggravating factors, are important. Well, 3553 gives defendants and defense attorneys more ammunition to argue that other factors that the guidelines, in fact, have found are impermissible could be grounds for a lower sentence.
But you argued all those here.
I beg your
pardon? All of those were argued here, weren't they?
No, Your Honor. They were argued under guideline analysis. In fact, the whole sentencing
guidelines
hearing
prohibited you from talking.
Exactly. In fact, the sentencing hearing that I understand happened today, and I wasn't defense counsel there, but it was about the number of pictures. As far as I understand it, at the sentencing hearing, a slew of information about the
what
pictures.
Would you have brought in now under the new scheme that you can bring in now that wasn't brought in then? What types?
Well, I think more can be made of what was brought in earlier, and I don't know that there are other factors.
Right, that's my point.
Well, but the guidelines. I'm sorry.
The judge did take into consideration all kinds of mitigating factors that you just read from the sentencing transcript.
But he did so without an ability to actually put it into effect in the sentence.
Well, that's what
without,
I'm wondering.
Outside
whether,
of range.
Whether the fact, for example, that he was limited to three notches down for acceptance of responsibility when Mr. Long was in this program already in the prison and so forth, maybe with more discretion. In other words, it may be a question of degree rather than a question of a particular point.
Right, and it could make a difference in the sentence is the point.
Well,
that it would.
The type of sentences used to be handed down prior to guidelines, for example, the classic one is used to show how the guidelines affected things, was the single mother of three, a teller who does embezzling, I can't think of all the other factors. None of those factors could be brought out in the sentencing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Her marital status could not be brought out.
That's right. In fact, the
fact that she's female.
Because of the type of offense, you can't argue for a lower sentence because this was a possession offense. in a possession offense for drugs, somebody could have been using for 4 or 5 years or longer, and the amount that they used didn't come up as a sentencing factor. However, in this case, the amount that was used came up all over his 5 years or so. So you couldn't argue that at the sentencing hearing for a lower sentence, but you can now. I see that I'm running out of time, but I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if that's all right. Thank you.
Mr. Keith?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tom Keith, and I'm an assistant United States attorney for the Central District of Illinois. I disagree with the statements that the court could not take these factors into consideration, maybe not for purposes of a downward departure, but certainly for a sentence within the sentencing guideline range itself as applied by the court.
You could take in marital status.
The court even mentioned some of these factors.
Well, I mean, notwithstanding the court mentioned it, I'm talking about what the guidelines provide.
Within the guideline range itself, but not for purposes of departing from those guidelines. But the court could certainly consider him in determining what sentence he should give that particular defendant within the applicable guideline range. Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, the judge departed upward 5 base offense levels and then determined what the additional guideline range would be and then sentenced this particular defendant to the very top of that range.
Right. If the judge had given those factors any weight, the sentence would have come in at the low end of the original guidelines range, not an upward departure.
Exactly. And he certainly had the room to if he wanted to give this particular defendant a lower sentence, he certainly had room to do that because he went up the 5 levels and went to the top of the range itself.
So we can reasonably read this sentencing transcript as establishing that the sentencing judge took note of the mitigating factors present in the case but gave them no weight and upwardly departed.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because certainly when you walk in, the judge has anything within his discretion prior to the Booker case, any sentence within his discretion within the range itself. And some of these ranges can be a large amount. And especially when you get to the higher levels, as in this case.
Isn't there significant evidence in this sentencing transcript also that the judge was substantially influenced by the egregiousness of the offense, both content and volume?
He was, and he stated so on the record. And in addition to that, he rejected the government's argument that he could have departed even further based on the molestation for 2 years of that 2-year-old girl that he adopted from Romania. And he never even considered that because he didn't feel that he could consider it if it wasn't relevant conduct to the instant offense. So not only did he base the sentence solely on the number...
Could he take it into consideration now?
If it went back, yes, he could, Your Honor.
So there's one example where he felt he couldn't take it into consideration,
but
he could.
He expressly did say on the record, though, that he can consider the molestation of the girl in determining what the sentence should be within the guideline. So just like the age, family ties, and the other...
But he might have gone beyond the guidelines because now he could plug that into his calculation.
That's correct, Your Honor. He could.
So, my point is not necessarily this case, but there are circumstances where he could receive a tougher sentence if those factors could have been brought in.
That's true, and that is an argument that we would not change. We would argue that he can consider that and in a further even departure if the case went back. I agree with counsel in this respect. I don't believe that limited remand in the context of the plain error standard would be appropriate. And I've listened to some of these arguments, and I've been talking to counsel, co-counsel of mine, you know, in the halls and stuff, and this is quite the topic of discussion. But in the plain error analysis, with respect to the third prong I'm still talking about, I would like to address the fourth prong a little bit because I think a lot of that has not been addressed about what constitutes a fourth prong. But
well, just to stay for one moment on the third, though, it's certainly true, even if you go back to Kuhn, and if you look at 5H, that there are factors that are prohibited factors under the guidelines. Now, some of those stem from constitutional constraints, such as race, and it's not because of the guidelines that that's a prohibited
right.
factor. It just is. But then there are all sorts of other things, like military, civic, charitable, public service, lack of guidance as a youth, and so on and so forth, those kinds of things, I don't see any constitutional compulsion to refuse to consider the guidelines. Made that as a policy choice. Don't you think that's now open?
Well, all of those issues with respect to Section 5 of the sentencing guidelines appeal with bases for downward departure. That doesn't preclude the other all those factors in being considered.
Well, but you couldn't downwardly you couldn't give somebody a lower sentence, which we would have called a downward departure in the guidelines world, and I guess we still do, to the extent the guidelines are to be used as guidance. And as I understand the opinion, it is now possible, obviously subject to constitutional constraints like the one I just mentioned, to look at those points. You don't have to regard them anymore as prohibited.
That's correct. And I think there's going to be a lot of litigation along those lines. And
you're right.
And what is reasonable and what is not reasonable. And I
just think, Mr. Keith, we're in the easy part of Booker right now.
Yes, I'm going to be here a lot, Your Honor. Yes. But with respect to the third prong, you know, in the plain error analysis, if a defendant objects to something, then he's dealt with a certain way when he comes up for appeal. But if he does not object to something, we're here on the plain error analysis. And it's part of that analysis that we're stuck with the record we have. And the issue really is not what would the district court have done. The issue is whether, based on the record, the district court would have done something different. And
even if the record is influenced by the structure the guidelines imposed, which is now gone?
Well, it's...
Why is that right?
Well... Because the plain error analysis, that's what the plain error analysis is based on the record that's before the court. If we expand the record, plain error does not afford the opportunity to expand the record. If that was the case, there would be no benefit to objecting below. It seems like we're taking the plain error analysis and standing it on its head when we send something back exclusively for the purpose of asking the court, what would you have done?
Under a different legal regime... Under a legal regime that would have changed the composition of the record. That's why evidentiary mistakes get noticed, because, you know, if you fail to give the jury evidence that would have influenced its decision, or if you put evidence in, you know, particularly the omission situation, the jury, you know, it's not easy to find plain error in those circumstances, but it's not impossible.
No, I don't think it's impossible either, Your Honor, but I think it has to be dealt with on the record that you have before you.
Well, but in the example I gave you where evidence was erroneously excluded, that's a hypothetical, too. The jury didn't see something it should have seen, and so that's really, in a sense, not on the basis of the record you have before you. Because you realize the jury would have understood the case quite differently had it seen this other evidence.
But there, on the record, there is evidence that there's proof that that evidence was out there and the jury didn't see it. It's still on the record that that evidence did exist.
Not always. I mean, I'm thinking of the Supreme Court's recent decision. I'm not going to remember the name, where the prosecution was concealing from the defendant the fact that there was a Batson problem or some kind of problem. And the Supreme Court said, you know, you were diligent enough. There's no way you could have found this evidence because they were concealing it from you, and you get relief.
If I could move on to the fourth, Your Honor, unless you have it. The other issue I have is, even if the third prong is established, that there was some prejudice in this case, that the result would have been different. In a case such as this one, and many of these others that are coming before the court, there has to be something more than prejudice in the fourth prong. Because if it wasn't, it would muddle and bring the third prong right in with the fourth prong. With the fourth prong, I submit that it's we cannot have faith in the outcome. Not that the outcome would have been different, but we could not have faith in that outcome. And in the guidelines, we've been operating under that system for almost 20 years. And really, not that much has really changed, Booker. I mean, we still have the preponderance of evidence standard. We still have the court considers the sentencing guidelines, must consider them, it must consider Section 3553 of Title 18. The only thing that has changed is that they are no longer mandatory, the guidelines, that they are advisory. And that's all that's changed. If there is a sentence within the guidelines itself that doesn't violate the law, or as long as it's within a range, then how could we not have faith in that sentence? Unlike in the context of collateral attack, when a miscarriage of justice is where the defendant has to prove he was actually innocent to constitute a miscarriage of justice. In the context of a sentencing, several sentences within a parameter could be a just sentence. There is no one just sentence. You take the same defendant, put him before different judges, and there could be many, many just sentences. So as long as it is illegal within the context of the sentencing guidelines itself, I would submit that the fourth prong could not be met, even if the third prong was, in cases like this one and many of the others. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. McGowan, your time had expired, but I'll give you two more minutes.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I just would encourage the court not to make a decision based on what's in the record per se. The guidelines have been in place for almost 20 years, 17 years, and to base a decision on whether to remand because there's judicial hand-wringing at this point in time in the guidelines wouldn't be fair to either the district courts who have been sentencing people under the guidelines for all these years, or for the defendants whose sentences have been determined by the guidelines. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Thanks to both counsel for your help. The case will be taken under advisement.